Hello and welcome to House to Astonish episode 60. I'm Paul O'Brien.
And I'm Al Kennedy. And in the week when the rapture is due to happen and a bunch of people are supposedly just going to disappear off the face of the earth, we ask, has Thanos finally got hold of that Infinity Gauntlet?
Coming up later, reviews of Non-Player, Flashpoint and Alpha Flight.
Yeah, but in the meantime, we're going to take a look at a bit of the news, starting off talking about something which developed in relation to the San Diego Comic-Con. San Diego, as a comic convention, has become much less about the comics over the past few years. I don't think anybody would deny that. It's become much more of a multimedia thing, and comics have kind of been shuffled into the corner a little bit. Certainly, the emphasis on things at San Diego is now more to do with, you know, big movie launches and, you know, Hollywood stars turning up and stuff like that. And comics companies will, more often than not, save big comics announcements for one of the later conventions of the season.
Absolutely. If you look at the announcements that come out after San Diego every year, there aren't any in relation to comics. Nobody announces stuff at San Diego. They announce it at Wizard World or Chicago or something like that. The announcements at San Diego are always about film and TV. So there's a gap in the market, I've thought for a while now, for something to emerge as the main convention for comics, because it's not Comic-Con. However, this is not what's happening here. This is something different. This is effectively the emergence of the San Diego Comics Festival Fringe.
Yeah, it's basically a kind of side event to San Diego Comic-Con. It's called Trickster. It's being set up literally across the road from the San Diego Convention Center, where the main con is going to be held. Something which has been originated by Scott Morse and Ted Mathon. Now, Scott Morse, you may know from his previous comics work. He's a fantastic artist and a very good writer as well. But he currently works at Pixar with this chap, Ted Mathon. They have set up this Trickster thing, which is going to be in the San Diego Cuisine and Wine...
Food and Wine.
Something like that. I can't remember.
It's an exhibition space across the road from the San Diego Conference Center.
Mm-hmm. And it's going to have retail space for creator-owned comics and prints and clothing and these sort of boutique toy kind of things that you can get, all based around the wares that are being sold by independent comic book creators for their creator-owned stuff. You know, you're not going to be getting people here saying, well, look, you can buy a print of the cover of my first issue of Speedball, The Revenge, or anything like that. The creators who are involved in it's pretty much a laundry list of some of the best creator-owned comic talent working in the American market at the moment. You know, people like Mike Mignola, Mike and Laura Allred are going to be involved in it, Paul Pope, Jill Thompson, Jim Mahfood, Greg Rucka. There's a huge list of people who are involved. And it's not just going to be a retail space, it's also going to be a gallery space, and there are going to be symposia and talks and such like happening at the same time. It really does seem to be the case that Morse and Mathot have decided, well, San Diego's not really about comics anymore, and it's particularly not about comics that can't be sold to make a movie quick buck for Marvel, DC, Dark Horse or Image.
Yeah, to the extent that it's about comics at all, it's about comics as licensable properties.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I think, a smart move, actually. It's trying to take advantage of the attention that Comic-Con gets and use some of that to deal with actual comics.
Yeah, the way that they've done it as well is pretty cool. I mean, they've got a website set up at the moment which has got loads and loads and loads of information on what's going to be happening, who's going to be involved, on the ethos of the whole Trickster thing. I think it's going to end up being kind of a gathering hub, this San Diego, for people who are more interested in the comics side of things than in the Comic-Con side of things, for want of a better way of putting it.
Feel professionally obliged to go to San Diego, but basically hate it? This could be for you.
People are apparently looking for a place to drink that isn't the Hyatt bar, given that the owner of the Hyatt is notoriously homophobic and donated a lot of money to the Proposition 8 thing. And yeah, people are looking for an alternative, and this could be...
And what, there's only one bar in San Francisco?
Well, it's in San Diego, but, you know, it's people...
San Diego. So.
People are looking for somewhere where the comic book community can gather, and traditionally this had been the Hyatt, just because, you know, big hotel near the convention centre. Trickster near the convention centre and doesn't have that nasty whole gay-hating thing going on.
Yes, well, that's certainly something it's got over the Hyatt. Kramer's Ergot. Ergo? Ergot?
Yep, Ergot.
Kramer's Ergot. Is that how you pronounce
yes,
it?
Yes, definitely.
Is returning.
Yes.
This time in a format that you can both lift and afford.
Kramer's Ergot, you probably will have heard of. If you don't, haven't heard of it, then it's a kind of art comics anthology, essentially.
Yeah.
The last Kramer's Ergot was, I think it was number 8. And it was the size of a paving slab, and it was $125.
It was astoundingly expensive. I mean, to be fair, while there weren't that many pages in it, the pages were very, very big. So it was the equivalent of having... And they were, I think, used with a lot of very small panels to the page. So
yes.
It was the equivalent of getting an awful lot of pages.
I don't think that... Sammy Harcum, who's the editor, I don't think he would... justify the existence of Kramer's Ergot on a value per square inch basis, but
no, I'm just saying
it's a high end product.
My point is,
it's an art book as well,
sure,
as being
sure.
a comics.
My point is, they didn't just take an ordinary comic and blow it up in size. They were doing something that tried to use the extra space. That's it.
Yep.
But it
had stopped being published, but it's now returning via a publisher called Picture Box, who are going to be publishing it at. Well, what one might call a normal size for a comic book. It's going to be slightly larger than your average, 22 page comic kind of thing, but it's going to be of the kind of length that you'd expect Kramer's Ergot to be. As a thing that is returning, I'm glad it's returning, because there was this gap for a really kind of the high end
anthology
style of thing. We've got anthologies that are creator-owned shorts that are being put out by people like Image and so on. You get your Flight anthologies and you get your Pop Gun anthologies.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they tend to be quite... I don't want to say populist because that makes it sound like a bad thing, but they tend to be, you know...
They don't go up to the serious, the high end of the art comic spectrum.
Yeah,
they're not trying to.
No, and you know they don't have to try to, because that's not what they're there to do. I mean, Pop Gun gave us Skull Kickers, for example.
Exactly, there's a gap in the market for something like Kramer's Ergot, which at the moment has kind of fallen to web comics, I guess. And it's quite good to have that.
Yeah, and the occasional book from McSweeney's, I suppose, yes. as well.
Solicits.
Yeah, we're going to go through the solicits just now. It's been a pretty quiet couple of weeks for comics, to be honest.
I mean, it's a quiet month for solicits for the simple reason that Marvel are halfway through a mega crossover. DC are in the last month of a mega crossover, and this happens all the time. Both companies want to launch all their new books coming out of that story, so inevitably there's not much going on in the last month and the month before that. So, yeah, there's a bit going on at Marvel. There's almost nothing happening at DC other than the Flashpoint wrapping up, but we'll run through this and flag some stuff up. You've put down at the top of this list Avengers 16. Why have you done that?
Because Brian Bendis is starting a romance with Hawkeye and Spider-Woman. It's like, well, here's one of Brian Bendis's favourite characters and he's getting them to have sex with one of his other favourite characters. At what point did Avengers just become Brian Bendis playing with his action figures?
Hasn't he just
dribbling on them?
Hasn't he just been doing a story with Hawkeye and Mockingbird over in New Avengers? Unless they're actually going to kill her.
Well, I haven't been reading New Avengers since the end of the first arc of that, because they swapped the artists out, and whilst I really like him, and I'm not really a big fan of Deodato. So I don't know what's been going on with Hawkeye and Mockingbird, but I mean, Jim McCann has been doing great work with Hawkeye and Mockingbird and essentially re-establishing what was a very rocky relationship between those two characters.
And Bendis has been using the same relationship in New Avengers, so it seems odd if he's going to do that in Avengers. Anyway,
yeah,
Ultimate Comics.
Yeah, that Ultimate Comics is probably Marvel's biggest launch for the month.
Ultimate Comics Hawkeye, the miniseries, and Ultimate Comics Ultimates.
So good, they named it twice.
These are both by Jonathan Hickman. Hawkeye's a miniseries, Ultimates is an ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
It's Hickman, so it should be interesting.
I'm not completely convinced yet that I actually understand what is the principle behind this relaunch.
The principle behind this relaunch is the last one failed and it must not be allowed to die.
That's the behind the scenes principle. I mean, what's the story principle? I mean, they're relaunching, obviously it's launching out of this whole death of Ultimate Spider-Man and Ultimate Fallout thing. And presumably there will be a new status quo there for the Ultimates and for the various characters that orbit that title.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, presumably why we'll be getting a Hawkeye series. But, you know, what I don't know is why should I want to read Ultimate Comics Ultimates except for the fact that it's written by Jonathan Hickman, you know, who's he's a good writer and I like his stuff. I find some of his more action-oriented comics can be a little intellectual. Like, I would like to see him just be able to cut loose and do a really stupid story, but that's not really his style, so I'm not going to get to see that. I think he could do it quite well. I mean, I'm really enjoying Secret Warriors, and a lot of people have gone off the boil on it from just talking to people on Twitter about it. I still think it's a really great series. I thought that the Last Ride of the Howling Commandos in particular was a really great story. But I can see where some people come from with saying Jonathan Hickman tends to write the intellectually detached superhero comics like your S.H.I.E.L.D. and really his Fantastic Four has been a bit like that as well.
Which to my mind makes him an interesting choice for Ultimates because he's as far removed from Mark Miller as you're going to get on the current Marvel roster. That suggests that either they've lost their minds or they really are trying to go in a different direction with the property.
Yeah, I suppose it can work taking somebody who's not known at all for doing a particular style of comic and putting them on that comic to see if they can do it. Jeff Lemire on Superboy is a good example. His Superboy is a great title. It got derailed briefly by that Doomsday nonsense, but apart from that, it's been very readable and very enjoyable.
But I think they're also saying, look, no, this is different. Look, it's Jonathan Hickman. Mm-hmm. Of course it's going to be different. And I think that's a message that it's kind of good for them to be sending with the Ultimate imprint right now. This has changed.
Yeah, for a while the Ultimate imprint, I mean, as we said last time round, it just seemed to be every so often everyone would get up, move around in a circle until the music stopped, and wherever they sat down, that's the book they would be writing.
Yeah.
And it was the same three or four guys doing the whole thing, and occasionally some people that Jeff Loeb had met in the canteen at NBC, you know, would come in and do some random Ultimate Scarlet Witch miniseries or something like that. But if they're actually looking at rehabilitating the Ultimate line, then good luck to them. How it's going to work, I don't know. I don't know whether they've lost too much faith from the comics reading audience.
Well, you know, if you're going to do it at all, you may as well put your heart into it, and they seem to be.
Yeah.
Spider Island. This is the sort of second tier crossover that's running alongside Fear itself. It's a Spider-Man story, obviously. Starts in Amazing Spider-Man 567. There's a tie-in issue with Venom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also three miniseries. Cloak and Dagger by Nick Spencer and Emma Rios. Spider-Girl, Paul Tobin and Pepe Larraz. And Deadly Hands of Kung Fu, Anthony Johnson and Sebastian Fiumara.
Yeah.
Now, Spider Island as a premise is basically everyone in Manhattan gets spider powers, isn't it?
It is. The solicitation for it said, if everyone has spider powers, then no one is Spider-Man. Which is just, it's not true. Like, if everyone has spider powers, then either everyone is Spider-Man, or around 50% of them are Spider-Man and the other 50% are Spider-Woman, or one of them is Spider-Man and the rest of them are in trouble. In no circumstance is if everybody has spider powers, then nobody is Spider-Man in any way true. It's like, where's Wally, possibly? You know, there's a lot of people in there with the red and white stripy shirts on, but only one of them is Wally. He doesn't stop being Wally just because there are lots of other people walking around with red and white stripy shirts on. By the way, translate to Waldo, depending on what territory you're listening from.
It's kind of a bit true. I mean, you couldn't have a superhero called Man-Man who was just a man with the proportionate strength of a man.
Yeah, Man-Man. He was bitten by a radioactive man, and he realises that with ordinary power comes ordinary responsibility. And he develops the proportionate speed, strength and agility of a man, and he's got the man sense, which means that he's able to detect all danger that a man can normally detect. Yeah, I think that could really work.
You're quite keen on Spider Island and on these tie-in minis, which do you're quite keen on these tie-in minis, which do have great creative teams.
That's why.
I, on the other hand, actually quite like what's going the general direction of Amazing Spider-Man at the moment, but have no interest at all in this as a crossover event. I mean, just the concept. I think it's fine as a Spider-Man story concept. I can see how that might make a perfectly good annual or two-parter with the Impossible Man in it. What I don't see is how it becomes, you know, a multi-part sprawling crossover, or how in any way it's a good setup for a Cloak and Dagger story.
Well, I guess Cloak and Dagger are, they are again now New York-based after the, I think, was it that Cloak and Dagger one-shot that came out, Stuart Moore wrote at the time of Utopia?
Yeah, which just writes them out of the X-Men cast.
Yeah, and writes them totally out of character, but anyway. I think they're back in New York now. They were Spider-Man supporting characters for a really long time. They started out in Spectacular Spider-Man. And if you're going to launch a Cloak and Dagger miniseries, then there's absolutely no point in not hitching it onto a crossover that's going past at the time.
But it's a crossover that's going to completely overshadow the characters. I mean, I have zero interest in reading Spider Island as a setting for some random Cloak and Dagger or Shang-Chi story. I just don't get that at all.
I see, I don't understand why it makes a difference. It's just, it's, that's the story that they're going to be operating against the background of. To be honest, whatever, I really don't care what story it is. It's going to be Nick Spencer, who's a great writer, and Emma Rios, who's a great artist, doing a 3-issue miniseries. I will read that. I would read it if it was, you know, The Amazing Adventures of Zabu in the Savage Land. I don't care if it's Spider Island or not. Spider Island as a concept is not exciting to me. You know, it'll be, I'm sure, fine. It'll take up 3 or 4 months or whatever. I'm not that bothered about it.
I mean, I'm sure these minis will sell more for being hitched to a higher profile story, but personally, I would have bought a regular Cloak and Dagger mini by Nick Spencer and Emma Rios, and I won't buy a Spider Island related one, because it just seems like such a bad idea for a Cloak and Dagger story.
See, it won't attract me into it, but it won't put me off it either. Which I think is, from both of our reactions, are absolutely not the reactions that Marvel want to get. What they want to get is, oh hey, it's a Cloak and Dagger miniseries by these two well-regarded creators. Oh, and wow, it ties into Spider Island. What's actually happening is one of us is going, oh, I guess it ties into Spider Island, I suppose. And the other one's going, oh, ties into Spider Island. Don't think so.
Secret Avengers. Warren Ellis takes over as the new writer, making the third writer that book has had in its first 2 years.
Yep.
Powerful direction they had in mind when they launched that one. Mm. Jamie McKelvey is drawing this issue. Apparently Ellis is just going to do a series of single issue stories.
Yeah.
Presumably he'll be doing 6 of them and then they move on to someone else.
Well, he said in the interview at the time when it was announced that he was going to be doing these 6 issues, that he's down to do 6, and he said to the editor, look, if these 6 go well and I haven't broken the toys and you want to keep me around, I wouldn't mind doing another 6. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how it works out after 6 issues. It might work really well, it might not, in which case I do 6 and I go, and the book can go on with somebody else.
It might well be fine, but I mean, it's interesting to me that you've got a book which was launched fairly high profile not that long ago as admittedly the Avengers C title, mm-hmm. but still a book that was, you know, top 10 title. And they've obviously got no direction in mind for it at all, because they don't even know who's writing it in 6 months' time.
Yeah, well,
even the writer doesn't know who's writing it, if he's writing it in 6 months' time.
They haven't said who's writing it in 6 months' time. I don't think there's any obligation on them to tell us everything that comes through their heads. I don't think we need to know who's going to be writing it in 6 months' time. We're interested, but that doesn't mean, because we don't know it, doesn't mean that they don't know it in Marvel.
Yeah, I think the danger with a book like Secret Avengers is that you give the impression to the readers that this is truly the totally superfluous book where we're just finding a way to fill the pages from month to month. And they are in danger of giving that impression. No matter how good the individual stories may be, it's very dangerous to send a message to the readers, yeah, we'll fill the pages somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess they've come
up... If there's one Avengers title you're going to skip, make it Secret Avengers.
The way that Warren's talking about doing it is it's going to be these 6 basically one-off stories.
Yeah.
And he's going to be picking and choosing from the cast of the Secret Avengers as they go.
Okay.
For each particular given story. Which is one of the things that I think Secret Avengers suffered a little bit from in its first year, which is... You go, right, some of the best Avengers teams ever have been some of the ones that have been a little bit random.
Yeah.
In terms of who's on the team. let's do that again. Let's take a bunch of characters that either have been Avengers or could potentially be Avengers, like your Valkyries and your Novas and so on. Put them all together in a team and see what happens. And what happens is they're not all really made for the type of stories they're telling. If you're telling Black Ops kind of super spy style stories, then Nova really isn't the great fit for that, which is why they took them immediately off Earth and put them on Mars, at which point Moon Knight's not a great fit for it.
Yeah.
When you're putting together a team that looks like it's random, you have to actually have thought about the kind of story that you're going to be telling with it. And I'm sure that they did think about what kind of stories they're going to tell with it, but then it just didn't shake out quite the way that they had perhaps intended it for it to work. Now, if Warren is doing a, let's take one or two characters, or you know, take some of the characters from Secret Avengers, do one-off issue, let's have a bunch of good artists doing each one, that's basically Global Frequency in the Marvel Universe. Global Frequency, the problem with it was that it was a patchy book. Some issues of it were really good and some issues were pretty terrible. Will the same thing happen with Secret Avengers? I don't know. Starting off, though, with Ellis and McKelvey working together again. They've not worked together, I don't think, since the Osborne miniseries.
They did a backup story for that,
which was good. You know, the two of them working together on this, I will at least buy the first issue of this.
Oh, I will as well. I think it'll be.
I think it'll probably be a pretty great issue.
I think it'll be a good single issue story. Yeah. Absolutely. Whether it'll be, where the series will be going in the long run. Incredible Hulks is cancelled with issue 635.
Yeah,
that's obviously going to be relaunched in some form. I mean, in the sense that they dodge the question when they're asked in interviews, so clearly it's going to be relaunched. But it does sound like it's the end of Greg Pak's run on that title, which goes back about 5 years or so.
Yeah, it's
to
crazy
the Planet Hulk storyline.
Yeah. It's amazing to think he's been writing it for that long.
Punisher. Relaunched.
Yeah.
Greg Pucker.
Greg Pucker. He's Jamie Oliver's favourite comic writer. Oh, it may be Greg Pucker. Greg Rucka.
And Marco Tichetto. On the one hand, I think the best thing Marvel could do with some of these characters who they've relaunched time and again is give them a couple of years off and then bring them back when the audience is ready for them again. It worked with Thor.
Yes, absolutely.
But, you know, if you're going to just relaunch them for the umpteenth time in a row, at least they're going for the big guns. At least they're going for a credible creative team. And they're saying, this is a book we're taking seriously. And
yeah, I got to applaud them for what they've done with these three Big Shots books, actually, because you've got Moon Knight has had about four launches in the past 4 years.
Something like that.
Some of them were minis, but still. He's had a variety of fairly, I would say, low-key creators working on the books.
Charlie Houston is probably the highest profile.
And even then, he was high profile because he was a novelist,
yes.
Not because he was
exactly,
you know, a big-name comic book writer. And what they did was they took one of the most successful creative teams that they've had in Marvel in the past 10 years, i.e. the creative team of the... probably still the best Marvel Knights Daredevil run. It tails off a little towards the end, I have to say, but Bendis and Maleev on Daredevil worked really well. And, you know, we reviewed Moon Knight last time round, and it's not bad. Seeing Mark Waid and Marcos Martin and Paolo Rivera are going to be doing Daredevil.
That should be good.
And Greg Rucka and Marco Tichetto, again, a good matchup. I think probably Tichetto is the least well known of all the names that are connected to these Big Shots books, but I have liked his art where I've seen it.
And yeah, Greg Rucka should be a good fit for Punisher. It's exactly his it's as close to his style as any superhero book is going to get.
Yes.
If the Punisher even really counts as a superhero comic, and it depends how much you use the Marvel Universe setting.
Yeah, I mean, Rucka showed that he could do kind of guns and ammo stuff in the Marvel Universe really well back in the day when he was doing Marvel Knights Black Widow stuff.
Sure.
And things like that.
But, I mean, the Punisher is only a superhero to the extent that he interacts with other superhero-type elements. If you leave those sort of things out of it, it's just a crime book.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Marvel Index is launching into a third run.
Normally talk about Marvel Index.
Some people think Marvel only care about the money. This series sells, you know, a few thousand. It regularly fails to make the top 300.
Yeah.
They're giving it a third run, this time covering the Punisher, Ghost Rider, and Wolverine. I obviously am delighted about this. I buy this series in single issues and in the collections because I want to support this fantastically pointless endeavour.
It's enormously quixotic, isn't it? Really?
It is.
I mean, I like to think that they're going, we will index everything that Marvel have ever published.
I can only figure that either these things are doing better in the collections than you might think, or somebody at Marvel actually thinks, you know, for our own internal records, it might be quite useful to commission this, and if we can get a bit of money out of it on the side, so much the better.
I'm looking forward to 10 years' time from now when they're launching issue one of Marvel Index Presents Brute Force, Motormouth and Kill Power and Mort the Dead Teenager.
I'm delighted it's getting another run. I don't understand how anyone's making money off this, but, you know, I'm not complaining.
Yeah, absolutely. The cross-gen revamps continue with Mystic, which is by the very enticing-sounding creative team of G. Willow Wilson and David Lopez. Now, G. Willow Wilson had been writing the truncated Vertigo series Air, which was an interesting and slightly odd tale of air stewardesses and terrorism and stuff. And David Lopez is just off the back of his Hawkeye-related commitments at Marvel. And again, they're taking a slightly rebootish tack to the property, where it's going to be still the two sisters who have these magic powers, but they're going much less the kind of, oh hi, I am cleavage, and more the kind of, the way that G. Willow Wilson described it was, Mean Girls meets Harry Potter, which sounds quite cool, actually. I'm quite interested to see it.
And collections, the book you probably will want to get, The Ecstatics Omnibus, 1,200 pages in hardback.
I think that makes it the largest book that they've ever published.
Literally everything connected with Ecstatics, including the Dead Girl miniseries and some of the shorts that were done for things like X-Men Unlimited and I Heart Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a collection is absolutely worth having.
Yeah, the John Byrne Fantastic Four Omnibus Volume 1 comes out as well. And from two books,
Spider-Man Next Chapter Volume 1, a collection of the John Byrne Spider-Man relaunch that was retconned out of continuity again within about a year.
Was it retconned out?
Yeah.
It's not
Spider-Man Chapter 1.
It's not Spider-Man Chapter 1, it's Spider-Man The Next Chapter, which is where he and Howard Mackey relaunched Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man.
But those stories deliberately tie into Chapter 1, and the elements that tie into Chapter 1 have had to be retconned out of continuity.
Due to it being so bad.
And you know, somebody must want this. A collection of everything involved with the Tom DeFalco Green Goblin series. Presumably because the character, Phil Urich, is now being used as the Hobgoblin and is cropping up in places like Spider-Man and Herc. But still, it's literally the entire run of Green Goblin, plus assorted tie-in issues, things like Amazing Scarlet Spider 2. I can't quite figure out who they think's going to buy that, but, you know.
I can't fathom who the audience for it is, unless it's people who like Scott McDaniel's 90s work. Because Scott McDaniel drew a fair bit of that series.
Actually, yeah, some of the art's not bad.
His art was great at that point in time.
Some of the art is quite good, now you say it, actually.
When he was just before he went on to do Nightwing, I think. And he was doing some brilliant artwork then. It is a interesting curio, and if you can pick it up cheap, then it might be worth seeing. But what it's not worth is $40 for 16 issues, which is where it is.
Over at DC, it's the conclusion of Flashpoint, and what's very notable about this this month's solicitations at DC is the number of DC Universe titles that use words like finale or end of storyline or things of that sort.
Or that running little one-issue fill-in stories, yeah, or whatever. They're all marking time until September.
Exactly. They're not all tying in with Flashpoint. In fact, virtually no other book ties in with Flashpoint apart from Booster Gold, I think.
Yeah, it's the only ongoing one that does.
But it's pretty clear that they're gearing up for some sort of major event in the DC Universe to come out in September.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that directly links to something that happens at the end of Flashpoint, where they're going to do another Zero Hour, effectively, which is what Rich Johnston's been suggesting,
mm-hmm,
that everything, that a lot of books are going to relaunch from one.
Yeah.
Temporarily.
I can't see it happening in the long term. I mean, you've got books that are hitting issue 900 or whatever. Do you actually sweep that away on a ongoing basis just to start over Action Comics 1 again. I really don't think so.
What I would do is I would officially keep to the regular numbering and then plaster the books with numbers for the parts of the cut of the new storyline.
Right, okay.
So you'd have a 900 in small print and then 1 being in a 2.
Oh, okay.
But you wouldn't officially change the numbering. So that when you go back to the regular numbering, it's not actually a cheat.
They should do it like Milk and Cheese did, and just every month it should be issue 1.
Yeah.
Milk and Cheese did, like, I think 5 issue 1s and then went on to issue 6.
But there's obviously some big thing coming in September, whether it's a continuity revamp or a big push for something that Flashpoint leads into. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But something is on its way. DC Retroactive. This is a series of one-shots featuring characters like the JLA, Batman, Superman, etc.
Yeah.
All done, in each case there's an 80s one and a 90s one.
Some of them have got a 70s one as well. One or two of them have got a 70s one.
And they've all got creative teams who loosely match the period. And they're just basically extra issues of, say, Batman in the Style of the 90s by Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle.
Which is interesting and good. I like Alan Grant.
Matheson McQuire doing the JLA for the 90s.
Yes!
And the JLA 80s is JLA Detroit.
Wonder Woman by Roy Thomas and Rich Buckler. Rich Buckler, I don't know what his art is like now, but I've been reading... I got the Deathlock Masterworks super cheap. And it's great artwork from Rich Buckler. Really, really fantastic looking stuff. And quite crazy a lot of points as well. Seeing what he'll be like nowadays on Wonder Woman, I really don't know. I'm hoping that he just has a complete brain frazzle and just draws Deathlock. Or Wonder Woman as Deathlock. Wonder Woman with half her face all zombified and the other half all metallic. And wearing that kind of W-shaped bustier thing.
You, sir, would have enjoyed the last arc of X-Force.
Would I?
Which features an entire horde of superheroes turned into Deathlock who had come back from the future.
but did Rich Buckler draw it in a mad fugue?
No, he did not. That's about it for DC, frankly, in terms of major stuff that's coming out. There's a Superman Beyond one-shot by Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz.
Spinning off of the Batman Beyond ongoing series that Adam Beechin's writing at the moment. Now, getting Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz in, that's, I don't think, any kind of coincidence pairing those two guys up. You know, somebody has gone, let's get the creative team that gave us Spider-Girl and then wouldn't take it away again. And get them to do a one-shot that spins out of the Batman Beyond series.
It's an odd choice, but Jonah Hex, Ryan Sook is doing guest art.
Yeah, we just flagged it up because Ryan Sook's a great artist. And I tend to buy Jonah Hex on a kind of fairly sporadic basis, given who's drawing on a month-to-month basis. I mean, they tend to have pretty great artists on Jonah Hex. But Ryan Sook drawing is an absolutely definite one for me.
Over at Vertigo, there is a memoir of the Cuban Revolution entitled Cuba, My Revolution.
Yep.
By an art... it's drawn by Dean Haspiel, and it's written by somebody whose name I can't read at this angle.
Inverna Lopez, I think that says.
Okay.
It sounds like it should be a Harry Potter-style anagram of somebody else's name.
Collections. There is a huge collected edition of the Sinestro Corps War.
Yeah, the
trade paperback.
Whole thing, the whole Green Lantern Corps, original Green Lantern stuff, all in one book. Sinestro Corps War is probably the last fantastic thing out of the Geoff Johns run on Green Lantern. And I would heartily recommend it. It's a great story.
And there's the first volume of 100 Bullets in hardcover, projected 5-volume series.
Yeah, covering the first 19 issues, I think it is. There's also Vertigo publishing one of these kind of DC Comics Presents style things, the Vertigo Resurrectors that they do, of the Johnny Double series, which again is Brian Azzarello and Eduardo Risso. I can only imagine that's been brought out in order to tie in with the 100 Bullets collections. We'll be able to quite quickly skim through Dark Horse, Image and IDW because it's a fairly quiet month for all three.
Dark Horse have got a new Angel and Faith ongoing series spinning off from Buffy Season 8. That's written by Christos Gage with art by Rebecca Isaacs. Could be good, actually. Christos Gage is usually reliable.
I like Christos Gage. I like his Avengers Academy a lot. I liked Avengers Initiative a lot. You really did not at all enjoy his contribution to Fear Itself, the Homefront, did you? Speedball thing. Translate that the into something.
I thought it seemed to involve unwinding a resolution to a story he'd only just finished, and I just thought there was something fundamentally stupid about the idea of Speedball going undercover in an organisation full of people who hate him by wearing a hat.
See, I can understand why they did the first part, because, well, if Speedball has come to terms with it, there are a lot of people in the Marvel Universe who haven't come to terms with Speedball, so what you need to do is kind of square the circle by saying, right, Speedball is okay with himself now, is everyone else okay with him? If you want to keep using Speedball, you kind of need to address the fact that there's a sizable portion of America who hates him.
But he did that in Avengers Academy about 2 months earlier.
He did it with Speedball and him, you know, coming to terms with it himself. I don't think, for instance, he didn't do it with the most visible proponent of this whole thing, which is Miriam Sharp, who is a terrible character. But, you know, I just think it's a plot point that needs to be squared away, but I think it could have been done in 1 8-page story. I don't think it needs to be necessarily a 7-issue miniseries.
Dark Horse Presents has a 12-page story by Dave Gibbons and also a 13-page preview of a new story by Jim Steranko.
Yeah, Jim Steranko. You don't get a lot of Jim Steranko or indeed Jim Steranko writing in comics nowadays. And the opportunity to get to see him do a creator-owned thing and get to see, you know, a reasonable chunk of it, 13 pages, that's enough to make me want to pick up this issue of Dark Horse Presents without even anything else being involved.
Image. Infinite, a series by Robert Kirkman and Rob Liefeld. This has a premise you'll never have encountered before. There's this guy like who's a freedom fighter from the future.
He's kind of cyborgy guy.
And he's travelled back in time, right?
Yeah.
To try and alter history and save the future.
Yeah.
The twist is,
you've heard this,
yeah,
one.
The twist is that he teams up with his own younger self to do it.
I would have loved to have seen the Rob Liefeld comic in which Cable comes back from the future in order to team up with baby Nathan. It'd be Lone Wolf and Cub, but without, you know how they did Cable, Lone Wolf and Cub with Hope. But it would be even weirder because it would actually be baby version of him. That'd be cool. It'd be like sort of Russian stacking dolls.
Savage Dragon reaches issue 175.
Yeah, well done to Eric Larson for getting that far through. There's a series called Severed coming out as well, which we should point out because it's a horror-looking thing by Scott Snyder, Scott Tuft and Attila Futaki. Scott Snyder has been getting great reviews for his work on American Vampire and also for his work on Batman with Jock. So if you've been enjoying that stuff, then be aware that there is this series coming out from Image in August.
And testing the limits of bookbinding technology, Invincible numbers 1 through 47 are collected in a $65 trade paperback.
Yep.
1,024 pages.
In colour.
Is that going to hold together beyond a week?
I don't know, I guess it depends how you print it. The Bone one volume edition is about that length and is, you know, holds together fine. Admittedly,
yeah,
it is printed in black and white on basically Bible paper, but, you know, I don't know what the printing is going to be like on the Invincible thing.
Infinite Jest holds together, and that's about the same length, it's about 1,200 pages.
Mm.
But it's rare to see a trade paperback of that length in comics.
Mm-hmm.
IDW, a new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collected edition. Sorry, New Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ongoing series, written on a work-for-hire basis by Kevin Eastman.
Yeah, Kevin Eastman, just to fill the background in or to refresh memories, Kevin Eastman, one of the creators of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles back in the day, along with Peter Laird, sold the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles about, when was it, about 2 years ago? Something like that. And IDW are now launching a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series. And they hired Kevin Eastman to write it. Now, I can't think of another circumstance where somebody has created a creator-owned comic, sold the rights to that comic, and then been hired on as an employee to work on it. I don't know whether this is something where he's needing the money and is being brought into it, or whether he's loving the fact that he gets to do the turtles again because he misses doing them, or, you know, whether
he can't
galled by this, or
he can't need the money unless he did something really stupid.
Google Kevin Eastman loses money, right?
Right.
Kevin Eastman's financial
is
story.
Is he the top hit?
I'm sure Kevin Eastman, if you Google Kevin Eastman loses money, you'll probably get something to do with Kevin Eastman and money, right. I would have thought. But yes, no, Kevin Eastman sold the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles because he needed the money, as far as I can tell.
There's also an outrageously expensive collected edition of the first 8 issues of the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles series. 312 pages, black and white with annotations. And it's, what was it again?
It's about $60 or something like that.
It's saying pretty pricey.
Yeah, it's a lot.
That said, these issues are not that easy to get hold of.
Yeah, there was a trade paperback of it, but it's way out of print now.
And IDW is also reprinting Nemovore, which, as I recall, was a series originally published by Vertigo. Ray Fawkes, Hans Rodionoff and Mike Huddleston. Mm-hmm. I remember that being a really good series.
I never read it. If it's really properly that good, then I will actually probably check this out. It's a kind of modern-day Lovecraftian kind
of
thing.
That's what they're going for. That's what they're going for.
Fair enough. So, that's solicitations. Will we go on to talking about some comic books now?
What should we start with? Flashpoint?
We'll start with Flashpoint. Let's start with Flashpoint. The top of the pile. Flashpoint. Right. DC's big summer crossover for this year. In fact, for, you know, not just summer crossover, just DC's big event for the whole of the year, so it seems, is this Flash-related story, Flashpoint. Now, I'm going to describe a story, and you tell me what the story is, right? Okay? Okay, you've got a hero who tries to be quite sort of upstanding as a pillar of the community, and somebody who has very, very close ties to that hero goes back in time, changes the past, and what we end up with is a world where everything is slightly similar but not quite the same. Some of the heroes are villains, some of the villains are heroes. Only one person in the entire reality remembers what the old reality was like. Go, what story am I talking about?
That would be Age of Apocalypse.
Yes, this is also Flashpoint.
It's also House of M. Yes, you're right, it is a basic setup that's been done before, but, you know, Age of Apocalypse was 15 years ago.
Isn't that scary, actually?
The statute of limitations has expired on reusing that idea.
I don't think it's a bad idea, either. I mean, Age of Apocalypse,
idea.
A great crossover.
This is this grows out of the Flash series, which has just ended, which wasn't altogether successful. They didn't even put out Flash 13, as I recall.
Yeah, well, they solicited and then cancelled it. It was supposed to have been coming out next month, I think, because Flash 12 came out the same week as Flashpoint 1.
Yeah.
And kind of leads straight into it.
I think it was running late on the artists as well, and they had to bring in fill-in art so that the final issue of Flash got out before Flashpoint.
How ironic is it that the people who are working on the Flash are not fast enough? But yeah, so the story is basically the world has changed, and it's something to do with something that the Reverse Flash has done. The only person who remembers the old world is Barry Allen.
Now, although this is a massive summer event, it's, I think, as we said, only crossing over into Booster Gold. Mm-hmm. The other books are all miniseries that have been launched specially for it. It is possible that some of these new characters may be sticking around afterwards, which might explain why.
Oh, the Nate Grays of Flashpoint.
Exactly. Hmm. And X-Man was such a success. Well, it made it to issue 75,
X-Man had intermittently good people working on it, but mainly it was a bit of a crock.
Ted J.H. Williams III for a while.
It had Steve Scroce, it had Stephen Grant towards the end, it had Alcatana, it had all kinds of
stuff. There was some okay stuff in there.
Unfortunately, it also had a lengthy run by Terry Cavanagh and Roger Cruz. But, yes. You know, it's not all fun and games.
What I like about this is that it's a Flash story. There's, at the end of the day, there's a clear story hook here. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's a Flash story, but it doesn't need to be a premise that works for the rest of the DC characters because they're not in it.
Yes, because it's not just when you're taking the other miniseries into account. A lot of these are alternate versions of the DC characters, but they're not all telling the Flash story. They're all telling their own stories within the world, because Flashpoint is two things. It's a concept for a story, which is the Flash through line, and it's also a world in which to tell stories, which I think is what differentiates it from Fear itself, which is a Thor story in which a lot of other characters are struggling to make their presence felt.
I was coming to that. I mean, what we've got here is, this is a Flash story because the Flash has woken up in a world where everything is different. He doesn't have powers. He's not, he doesn't have his wife, but he does have his beloved mother back. There are other things. Yeah, it's not all bad. The things that are better in this world For the world as a whole, things look to be significantly worse, but mm-hmm. you know, only for foreigners. If you're American, things are basically fine. It's a world where there's, you know, some trade-off to be made in terms of, you know, would you really want necessarily to change it back if you were Barry Allen? I like the idea that because he remembers the real world, although he has no powers, he does still have the advantage of knowing things other people don't, or at least being able to make an educated yes. guess at how to get in touch with Batman and things like that.
Yeah. The thing that he has on the, you know, knowledge of all the superheroes thing is good because he's got so little knowledge of all the other stuff that's changed. Like to the extent where he has to ask his mum if he owns a car.
Yes.
That kind of thing. These are neat retouches because he doesn't know the world, but he does know these people.
The other thing, the other side of this story is that over in Europe, you've apparently got some sort of war going on between mm-hmm. Wonder Woman leading the Amazons and Aquaman leading the Atlanteans. Mm-hmm. That I'm less interested in, but to be honest, so long as it remains the background of a Flash story, I don't really care.
Yeah, it does seem like it's there so that some of the spin-off minis can have something to do. You know, you've got your Aquaman miniseries, you've got your World of Flashpoint miniseries, you've got your Lois Lane series, and you've got your Wonder Woman miniseries. Those four look like they're going to be dealing with the Aquaman, Wonder Woman side of things.
Well, also, I think it's there so that Barry ultimately does have a motivation to choose to switch back to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of this story that isn't really brought out in the comic itself is the Reverse Flash and his role in the whole thing, which you need to have read the build-up for. But I mean, I don't think it undermines this story if you don't know that, because I'm sure they'll get to it in later issues. But the setup that they introduced in Flash before this was that the Reverse Flash has been going back through time, altering his own history in an attempt to make things work out better for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that he can't alter is killing Barry Allen, because if he does that, he'll derail history and then he'll never have become Flash.
Yeah.
But by changing history in this way so that Barry Allen never became the Flash, he should have derailed his own history.
So something is odd here.
Either there's a plan that the Reverse Flash does show up in a couple of cameos
to show
that, you know, there's more to this than meets the eye. If you know the background, there's an interesting mystery as to what exactly the Reverse Flash is playing at by creating this world in the first place. I think there's a lot in here that works as a Flash story, and if it doesn't necessarily work as a line wide crossover, that doesn't really matter because it's not.
Yeah, we don't really need to. I mean, I'm sure you probably could just read Flashpoint and get all the story that you wanted to get. Similarly, and I think this is one of the things about Fear Itself that I would applaud, they seem to be doing something similar with Fear Itself in that, yes, the story is being told in Fear Itself and it's a Thor story. Thor is not tying into it, so you don't even need to read Thor if you don't want to. The only extra bit that you need to really read to understand it is the prologue one-shot, which dealt with Sin and the Red Skull.
The problem with Fear Itself is that it is crossing over into all these other titles, and it's not a story that belongs in those other titles, because Fear Itself is a story about old gods coming back to fight the Asgardians, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's been sort of artificially turned into something that affects other characters by having a bunch of people with hammers wandering around fighting people. But, you know, character X comes to have a fight with me is not a story. It's not an interesting story. It's not a hook that makes you want to read those other things. Do you really think that the baddies with hammers are going to have some massive impact in the Marvel Universe? Not for a second. Whereas at least with a concept like Civil War, you could see how you could do how each individual book could make that their own story. You could play with that in some useful way. Fear Itself just becomes a guest villain comes by to hit you with a mallet. And that doesn't work as a premise for a line-wide crossover.
What I like about some of the tie-ins that are going on with Fear Itself, though, is that because they are so removed from what's going on with the Thor side of things, they can just quietly go on and tell whatever story they want to with Fear Itself as a backdrop. There's sort of slightly more intrusive Red Skies crossovers.
Yeah,
with things like the Youth in Revolt thing and whatever. You know, that's basically an origin story for a new initiative, with a bunch of characters from the old initiative and from Young Allies and New Warriors and so on. It's only tangentially related to Fear Itself, but it gets to benefit from having the Fear Itself banner on the front of it. They are brought together for a reason, which is linked to Fear itself, which is this whole Blitzkrieg thing is going on, and Steve Rogers wants to mobilise everyone as quickly as he possibly can. And it doesn't need to be the case that they are fighting a dude with a hammer, or that they're facing off with Thor or anything like that. They can just go off and do their own thing, and I'm pleased they've done that, as opposed to what they did with Secret Invasion, where every crossover was necessarily exactly the same. And with Dark Reign, where every crossover was necessarily exactly the same. The amount of comics that we had to read that were...
Sodding Skrulls.
Ah, the Skrulls have turned up. Well, that was a surprise. Or in Dark Reign, sorry, the end of issue cliffhanger of this is that Norman Osborn's turned up with the Dark Avengers to fight us. Right.
Boy. Yes, I mean, creatively, you're right, but commercially, I think it's a really bad idea to solicit a whole load of Fear Itself tie-ins, which all turn out to be red skies.
Mm-hmm.
That's a breach of faith with the reader. And, you know, Marvel don't care about this, obviously, because of the way they've behaved over the last few years. But if you keep selling the reader things which turn out not to be true, then eventually they stop believing the hype.
Well, they tie in with the series. Whether they actually affect the series or not is completely up for debate.
That's yes, that's the thing.
But the thing is that we also say as well, as comics readers, we don't want to have to buy all these tie-ins in order to get the full story.
But they've refused to tell you which ones you actually do need to buy. Deliberately.
I think you probably can, you know, not go wrong buying the Avengers books, for instance, and you know, Journey into Mystery, if you're wanting something that's tying into Fear Itself strongly.
I think the problem with doing tie-ins that way, when there's so many of them, is a lot of readers are going to think, well, I'm not going to buy all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm not going to buy all of them, what's the point in buying any of them? Because I'm not getting the entire story, so I'm not going to pick up this issue just to find out more about Fear Itself.
Well, for instance, what I'm doing with Flashpoint is I'm buying the Flashpoint series. I'm also buying, I think, 3 or 4 of the minis, not because I think they're going to tell me the stories that I want to particularly read to be able to follow Flashpoint, because I'm reading Flashpoint, and if there's extra stuff that feeds into Flashpoint, fine. If there's, you know, not extra stuff that feeds into Flashpoint, I'm still going to be getting a series which is by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, or that's by Jeff Lemire, or that's by Peter Milligan and George Perez. You know, I'm buying these things because I think they sound interesting.
Sure. And I'll be buying the Peter Milligan and George Perez one. But I think this sort of promotional strategy of crossovers and massive numbers of tie-ins used to work because it played to completism.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers of books that are being produced are now so high that nobody can afford to be a completist.
Yeah,
and if the only reason why people were buying most of these books was completism, the moment you'd make completism impossible... people have no other reason to buy the tie-ins.
There are 22 tie-ins to Flashpoint in June. That's just the Flashpoint, all the Flashpoint minis and Booster Gold.
Nobody's going to buy all of them, apart from a handful of completist freaks.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I've been that sort of reader in the past, but, you know, I was in the fortunate position of being able to afford them.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of people cannot afford that many. They therefore cannot afford to buy all of them. And once you've decided you're not going to get the entire story, what's the point in buying random Flashpoint title X that you aren't otherwise interested in? Because it's not to get the whole story, because you've already resigned yourself to that.
Well, I think then you just have to take the tack that I've decided I'm going to be taking, which is look through previews, look through solicitations. What looks interesting? What might I enjoy reading more work by these creators?
I think it's the same issue affects things like the X-Books at the moment. There's way too many X-Men titles for most people to buy all of them.
Yeah.
Therefore, when they launch something like X-23 or Daken, they don't sell in great numbers because virtually all readers have already given up on the idea of getting the entire line.
Mm-hmm.
If you have smaller
books as well, of course.
If you have a smaller line, then people will buy the entire thing, even if they don't necessarily want it.
Which is why I think the Marvel Cosmic books kept such rock-solid sales figures, was because you only had two books in the line. They were telling it their own little world series. Sometimes there were, you know, a tie-in mini or an event mini or something like that going on at the same time, but you never got more than, say, 4 books in a month from the Cosmic line. And so you could follow the whole thing. It was manageable, and because it was being led essentially by the same two writers, the whole thing had a coherency to it that a lot of the big sprawling lines just don't have.
But whatever you think of Flashpoint as a line-wide crossover, it does actually work as a Flash story.
Yes.
And I thought the art's... he's not my favourite artist, Andy Kubert. He's never has been, but he's fine.
My favourite Kubert, Andy Kubert. He's doing okay at this. He's got a great handle on action scenes, as he always has done. He has terrible taste in haircuts, as he always has done. Oh my goodness, the guy, Director Singh of the CSIs.
Now that is a mullet.
That's a mullet and a half. The guy looks like he stepped directly out of a Superman book from the 90s. Flashpoint, I think, on the basis
maybe
of the
that's
first
one of the
issue,
things that's changed in this world, that the mullet
the
is
mullet
a fashion.
Is, mullet is cool.
That would be brilliant. The JLA travel to an alternate reality where everything's basically the same, except everyone's got a mullet.
House of M for mullets. So Flashpoint as a first issue, I think pretty successful. The only thing about it which I would say is stupid is the fact that you've got a second last page which builds up to a big gasp reveal, and to get the big gasp reveal you have to go through three pages of adverts
for Flashpoint
and then stop on the last page. It completely breaks the rhythm of the comic.
That's incredibly stupid, because they're breaking it up with house adverts for the book you're currently reading.
Yeah.
Madness.
Anyway, Flashpoint, there you go. Alpha Flight
number 0.1.
Where we reach a new low in madness of numbering books.
No, that would be Iron Man 2.0 number 7.1, which is coming out in August.
Yeah, well done, whoever thought that one up.
Did somebody not once put out an issue Pi?
I can't remember.
I have a vague feeling somebody did. I may be wrong. Some obscure indie book.
Interesting when people go by strange numbering schemes, like the Deathmate books, where it
Deathmate
was
Mauve.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Deathmate Cyan. But yeah, so Alpha Flight are in this kind of strange position at the moment in the Marvel Universe, where a lot of them were killed by Brian Bendis as part of the Woeful Collective storyline.
A few of them had been killed off before that, to be honest. The Alpha Flight that Bendis killed off were mostly C and D listers.
And some of them were, you know, so your big guns as well, but a lot of them were brought back during Chaos War in a one-shot.
In a very hand-waving fashion, but it's sort of, hey, remember that story where Alpha Flight died? Don't.
So they were brought back in this one-shot during Chaos War, all except for Puck, who is still dead but is on covers for later issues in the series, so I presume he's going to be in some way playing into the story.
Well, Puck was still being used in the afterlife in Jason Aaron's Wolverine Goes to Hell story, which did create an issue with bringing him back from the dead simultaneously in Alpha Flight. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably the reason.
Yeah, he didn't make it through the Chaos War one-shot. But now what you have is the majority of Alpha Flight are back together. North Star is not with the team, but apart from that, the rest of the team are kind of grouping back together again.
North Star is in the comic, but he's not a member of the team. Mm-hmm. He's refused to rejoin because he's North Star.
Because he's being a snippy little bitch, as he always is. What a grumpy git he is.
It's nice, frankly, to see North Star back in with the collection of characters that he was designed to be with, rather than doing what he's been doing for the last few years, which is being the token homosexual in the X-Men.
Yeah.
And that's literally all he does.
I honestly have never thought he works very well with the X-Men, because he doesn't have any sort of chemistry with any of the characters.
No, he doesn't. And Joe Casey, I think, made a very good point once when he said that, you know, the last book that needs a character to play that role is the X-Men, where the central metaphor is already covering that territory. Yes, diversity, but if all the books where you're going to plug in a character just to be the token gay, mm-hmm. The X-Men is the last title that benefits from having such a character there. The Avengers would get more out of it.
Yeah, and I think he works much better in an Alpha Flight setting, because he's not the token gay, he's North Star of Alpha Flight.
Yes, exactly. And he's got a character here.
Yeah. The writers of this, we should say, are Greg Pak and Fred Van Lente, two guys whose work I have massively enjoyed over the past few years. Mm. Greg Pak is currently writing a surprisingly enjoyable Silver Surfer miniseries, and they're currently together working on Herc as well. And yeah, they're just a pair of really great writers.
Now, John Byrne, I think, has said that with hindsight, he thinks giving Alpha Flight their own series was a mistake.
Yeah, he doesn't think that they were... He didn't create them to have personalities, he created them to be an obstacle for the X-Men.
Exactly, they're basically a list of characters with Canadian stock themes, yeah. Which is true. They are.
Let's make one of them a shaman. Let's make one of them something to do with our, you know, Inuit gods.
Let's make one of, or a North Star. One of them's wearing a Canadian flag. And you know, his view was that they weren't set up in such a way as to make them viable in the long term as, mm-hmm. as characters. Tom Brevoort, I think, has said similar things, that the problem with Alpha Flight as an ongoing series is, you know, what's the premise of this team? They're the Avengers of Canada. Well, hold on. That would be the Avengers, because the Avengers are already the Avengers of everywhere. So, you know, all you're left with is yeah. is the geography. And that's, I think, whether that you accept that as being a fundamental flaw in the team or not, I think it's certainly true that on many occasions they've been allowed to slip into being a team who are the generic superheroes who happen to be from Canada.
Yeah.
And I think what Pak and Van Lente are trying very hard to do in this first issue is build them all up as characters and say, you know, what is this book about? It's about these people. Alpha Flight is not about, you know, whatever group happened to be called Alpha Flight at the time. It's specifically these characters, in the same way that the Fantastic Four is specifically...
Yeah, you look back at old Alpha Flight relaunches. The last one was a dreadful failure because its pitch was, let's do Alpha Flight, but let's do it as a sitcom. The fatal flaw in it is that it's not funny.
That really was an oversight.
It was, I mean, you're going to make a comedy comic and forget to put any good jokes in it, then it's not going to work. The previous relaunch of Alpha Flight was the Stephen T. Siegel and Duncan Rulo version.
Which didn't feature the original team.
It featured Puck, but that was literally...
I think there was a Vindicator in it as well.
There was, but it was a robot version of Mac Hudson.
Yes, and there was a Sasquatch, but it wasn't the original Sasquatch.
No, it was an actual Sasquatch, yes. Which I think is hilarious. It's like, how terrible friends are you guys to Langowski when you can't even notice that you've brought in essentially a wild animal, and you've just gone, oh yeah, Walter's just having a bad day. He's really got up the wrong side of bed this morning.
Alpha Flight are kind of Marvel's version of the Doom Patrol, in the sense that the name has been attached mm-hmm. to so many weird and misconceived variations on the central team.
Yeah, because the last thing that was anything to do was Omega Flight, which was Mike Oming and Scott Collins' version.
Which had the US agent in it.
I know, I'm talking about missing the point. I mean, I really like the US agent as a character, and I really like Beta Ray Bill, who was also in there, but there's one place they don't belong, it's in Alpha Flight.
Weapon Omega, for God's sake.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it wasn't a particularly well-conceived idea, I don't think. Although it was actually a fine enough series, but it wasn't an Alpha Flight comic. But I think that what people who are fans of Alpha Flight are looking for, and there are fans of Alpha Flight, every character that, you know, had their own book back in whenever has got some people who go, oh, you know, I wish they would bring back whatever. But what they want to see is this group of characters. It's not the name that they're interested in seeing necessarily.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like when they brought back New Warriors and it was a total bomb, and partly that was because it was appallingly badly written with pretty sketchy art with lots of fill-ins. But it was also because it had nothing to do with the New Warriors. It's like, you know, as a New Warriors fan, I would have wanted to have been picking that book up and going, oh great, well there's Night Thrasher, Justice, and Nova, and all these kind of characters that I know can work as a team, and I know that have got good chemistry together, because over the course of however many issues, you know, that was put together and all the knots were worked out of it, as opposed to something that just called the same thing. DC, I think, have had a similar problem with launching things like Dead Man and stuff like that, with completely different versions of the character that I've got literally no relationship at all to previous versions. I think that there is a certain feeling within the big two companies which is wrong, which is what people want to see is the IP return. They want to see a comic that's called Alpha Flight, or that's called Dead Man, or that's called New Warriors, or whatever. And what we need to do, because those previous ones got cancelled, is we need to change what is in it, because that obviously didn't work.
Yeah.
And that's not a successful way of doing a relaunch. Well, Silver Surfer, when they relaunched it in about 2003 or whenever it was, 2004, and the Silver Surfer wasn't really in it. It was about a single mum and her kid.
That was a real mistake.
Totally missing the point. Call it Silver Surfer. Put the Silver Surfer in it.
I mean, I think, yes, if you're going to revive a series, you need to find a new angle on it.
Yes, absolutely. But there's no point in just retreading for nostalgia's sake. I mean, I'm not advocating that.
And by all means, cycle in some new characters into the cast.
Absolutely.
You can do that in a team book.
Yes, completely.
But fundamentally, if you're not going to bring back the original team, why bother bringing it back at
all?
Exactly.
Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you want to get rid of the reasons why the last version didn't work. Okay, fine. Maybe the stories that you were writing in it were too convoluted or were too basic, one or the other. You know, or maybe they lost track of what the whole thing was supposed to be about. Maybe they cycled in too many new characters and too many of the old characters, and people were saying, well, this isn't really the thing I want to be reading about anymore. Maybe the people who were working on it were just bad. Maybe it was just a bad comic.
To be fair, counterexample, the X-Men, brought back in 1975, bearing almost no resemblance to the previous series and went on to great success.
Yes, I suppose.
So
it's
not
the
an invariable rule.
Yeah.
But with Alpha Flight, I think, you know, the appeal here to the people who care about Alpha Flight at all is the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody really wants to read a bunch of C-listers who happen to be calling themselves Alpha Flight this week.
Yeah, I'm sure if this was being brought back and it was, you know, Flex and Radius and Murmur and all those characters, then there wouldn't really be any interest in it at all. This at least has got some interest around it from what I can tell online, but from the fact that it is the Alpha Flight that people would think of when they think of Alpha Flight.
With a good creative team as well.
Yeah, I mean, I have no real nostalgia for Alpha Flight or anything like that, or attachment to the characters. But, you know, I'm buying this Alpha Flight series because it's Greg Pak and Fred Van Lente, and it's going to be drawn, the main series can be drawn by Dale Eagleship.
It's also a good point one issue. Mm. And I'd have to say it would also be just as good as the first issue of a regular, of a miniseries. Mm-hmm. But it does what it needs to do in a first issue. It introduces all the cast members, gives them some time to establish their personalities. It has a threat for them to deal with in the course of this first issue. And it introduces the wider threat that will be the subject of the first storyline.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so hard, Brian Bendis?
Naming no names, but Brian, really, why can't you do this?
In your team books. You can do it in your solo titles.
Yeah,
you
just
can't
your
do
teams.
It in your team books.
Yeah, so this story is essentially the various Alphans being brought back together by a fairly low-powered threat, but a low-powered threat that is hinting darkly at the existence of a much greater threat in the world of Canadian politics. Now, that's not a sentence you get to say very often.
A much darker threat in the world of Canadian politics. The Liberal Democrats are on the march.
But yeah, so the various characters each get a good few pages of panel time and the opportunity to show off what they're really about. They all get to do their shtick. I mean, the only one really, I don't think, that gets to do anything that particularly demonstrates their personality is Heather Hudson.
Yeah.
The rest of them all get quite a bit of decent panel time.
You're right, actually. Heather does have a bit of a plus one role here, doesn't she? Which might need to a bit of work. But, you know, there's eight issues in this mini.
Yeah, the difficulty with Alpha Flight as well, and the role of Vindicator stroke Guardian, has always tended to be that either Heather or Mac was there.
They were never intended to both do the same role at the same time. But
yeah. But in terms of this story, it's not something that's got huge earth-shaking repercussions for the Marvel Universe or anything like
no,
that.
No, not at all.
But what it is a great introduction to this team. If you ever thought, well, oh, they bring back Alpha Flight, who are these guys? Why should I care about these guys? This actually demonstrates quite well who the characters are and gives you an opportunity to see whether you actually do care about the characters and are interested in seeing more of them. I am interested. I know that, again, a crossover is putting you off buying the main series.
Yep.
On the basis of this, I will tolerate the crossover tie-in just to read a Pak and Van Lente comic book, which, on the basis of this, is going to be well-written, and given the fact that it's Dale Eaglesham drawing it, it's going to be well-drawn. Whereas, are you more on the lines of, I would have done, but I won't because it's
for itself. I'm not interested in reading tie-ins to that. I think it's a weak concept, Fear Itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, instinctively, my feeling is that any book that is doing a Fear Itself tie-in is probably going to be worse off for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, this point one issue at least doesn't tie into Fear Itself in any noticeable way.
In any way at all.
So you're quite safe in picking up Alpha Flight 0.1 and I honestly would recommend it. It's a type of superhero book that I don't think you see much of nowadays, which is the well-written, self-contained, well-drawn, entertaining, non-angsty, non-cynical superhero comic.
Absolutely. If you're a fan of Alpha Flight, you will love this.
Yeah, and if you're just a fan of a different take on a team book than the rest of Marvel is doing at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. It's certainly got that going for it, that it's a style of team book that nobody else at Marvel is doing right now.
Moving on to Non-Player from Image. Now, Non-Player issue 1 came out about a month ago. We couldn't get hold of copies of it at the time. This is the second printing, which came out, I think it was last week. So, Non-Player, go. What's it about?
Well, you start off with this sort of fantasy sequence with what seem to be characters talking about internal squabbles in their army and the possibility that the leader's partner, wife, girlfriend, whatever, is possibly up to no good.
Yes, and then Hanky Panky with a demon.
Yes, and then some other characters show up who are clearly at least think that what they're involved in is that they're playing some sort of RPG.
Yeah, they're raiding this caravan, but then when you get halfway through the issue, they've both been killed, these two raiders, and they rematerialise
In the game's lobby. But the strong implication is that the other characters in this fantasy world might not be just straightforward non-player characters after all. And then after that, it goes into a sequence focusing on one of the girls in the near future real world, where she's basically living in this sort of VR version of the world that makes everything look beautiful when in fact it's all a bit of a dump.
Yeah, she seems to live in... It's actually quite interesting. The world that the girl lives in her normal life looks a lot like Brandon Graham's King City.
It does, doesn't
which
it?
Which is interesting because there's actually a pin-up by Brandon Graham at the back of this book. But she is a tamale delivery girl who has got this pretty much addiction, as far as we can see, to playing this video game, this fantasy-style video game. And she doesn't seem to really be able to face up too well to reality, because even when she's driving around, she likes having the, sort of the VR skin on the world, which show it up to be a kind of a fantasy world. But, as we say, the sort of subplot to it, the subtext to it, is that the fantasy world that she's playing this game in may have more to it than just being a VR game.
I'm wondering if the idea might simply be that that it's so sophisticated that the non-player characters who are being cheerfully slaughtered by the players have developed sentience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which...
And don't realise that they're in a game.
Yeah, that could be an interesting tactic if that's the way it goes. As it's the first issue, we don't get to delve too much into that. What it is a lot of kind of setting of the scene and the premise, really. But without the plot, really, of the kind of... where it's going to go from here.
It sets up the premise, it makes the premise a mystery, it sets up the characters. I think it does enough for the first issue, although you're right, it doesn't really get into it doesn't really launch itself fully into the plot. I think it's got quite a lengthy opening sequence setting up the game world with an extended fight scene that goes on for about 8 pages, actually. Mm-hmm. It takes about a third of the issue. I suspect in pacing terms it may well read better in the eventual collected edition, but the art is absolutely beautiful.
Yes, Nate Simpson, who is the writer and artist of this book, has done the whole thing himself. He is an incredible artist. The art in this comic is stunning.
It's gorgeous.
It's got a very kind of heavy metal style feel to it. Not in terms of the music style,
really?
But in terms of the...
It's cleaner than that, I would have thought. I mean, in terms of, yes, the style of the fantasy world, yes. But the visual... how do I put this? Yes, I see that the decor of the fantasy world is the sort of thing you get in
the kind of thing metal. Was what I was thinking of. Less the very thin line style that he has.
Yes, it's a lot cleaner. I mean, it is quite European in a way, but...
Yeah. Actually, see when this is collected, tell you what I'd love to see would be a big kind of Bondissime style hardback.
Yes.
The way that Casanova was first collected. Like, I would love to see that. That'd be fantastic. The world that has been put together here in terms of the fantasy world is one of these kind of things where you, just from the way that it's been drawn and designed, everything looks like it's been made for a purpose. And everything looks like there's more story to it than what you're seeing actually on the page, which is great. It makes it look like a world that could actually be lived in by characters.
That's a really good point, actually. He's put a lot of thought into all the background detail in this.
Mm-hmm. And then even things like the game lobby, which you only see for two pages, has got its own distinct look and style. And then when you get into the real world, it again has got a lot of little tiny touches which really help to sell it. Things like the girl's bedroom has got a plant in the corner which is practically dead. Most of the leaves are off it and are lying on the ground, and above her bed there's a sign that says water the plant.
Yeah,
all that kind of thing. And then again when she gets outside, she is in this very King City-esque world. It's what I think is interesting is that it's kind of somebody who doesn't want to live in a science fiction world, who wants to live in a fantasy world.
Yes, that's a good point, but it's got this sort of collision of two genres.
Mm.
And it's clearly not a particularly great sci-fi world. It's a bit King City, it's a bit... I'm not sure it's really dystopian, actually.
No, it's just a bit grubby. Sort of,
it's just in a city.
Yeah, and just a bit dirty. I'm really looking forward to seeing the next issue of this book. I think this is a fantastic first issue from somebody who's going to really prove himself to be a properly major talent in indie comics.
Yeah, and this final double page spread is just gorgeous.
Yeah, absolutely amazing.
I think I may wait for the trade because I think, you know, aside from the fact that he's quite open at the back about not really knowing when the next issue is going to come mm-hmm. out, I think the way it's being done will work better in a single sitting
yeah.
than in installments. But it is an absolutely beautiful piece of work.
Yeah. So that is Non-Player, and that's the comics for this week. And we're going to move on now to the official handbook of the Marvel Universe.
What have you got?
Now, well, we're in your area of the Marvel Universe. We're in an X-Men villain.
Ah, oh.
Yes, this is a villain from a very, very special episode of the X-Men.
Very special.
This is the villain from Heroes for Hope, starring the X-Men, a character called Hungry.
Yes, it was a subtle comic, Heroes for Hope, starring the X-Men. Have you ever read it?
No, I believe it's something to do with a famine in Africa or something.
It's the Ethiopian Famine Relief issue
right, okay.
from 1985.
Okay.
And it's a jam issue.
Okay. There's this one that Stephen King writes a couple of pages
yeah,
of.
Yeah, or script, yes.
Right.
There's a loose plot written by Chris Claremont,
mm-hmm.
and different artists did every page, and different writers were brought in to do the dialogue for every page.
Right.
And yes, Stephen King did dialogue a couple of pages of it, and they're all credited. And it's,
does it work or is it a mess?
It works better than you might think, in the sense that there is actually a story.
Right, okay.
But it is a story in which the X-Men encounter a psychic parasite called Hungry.
Yeah, Hungry is it's some sort of either a demon or a primal mutant from the dawn of humanity, according to this thing, which makes me think that they really hadn't thought it through very much.
It's a thingy. It's a thingy that the X-Men must fight.
There's a baddie. It's a baddie called Hungry who lived in this temple and basically fed off of negative emotion and so on.
It's one of these despair-type characters.
Yeah, and apparently the Ethiopian famine made it stronger and stronger and stronger. And then he decided to target the X-Men for some reason. He says possibly because Storm's ancestors were among those who once battled it. Now this sounds to me like a handbook writer trying to make sense of a very stupid storyline.
Yes.
And he fought the X-Men, and Rogue used her powers to steal the rest of the X-Men's powers to battle Hungry, but Hungry possessed Rogue. And yeah, eventually they just had a big fight and beat up this monster.
Yeah, that's essentially the issue.
Yeah.
It was a jam issue, you know. I remember it reading a little more coherently than that makes it sound, to be honest. But well, yes.
Well, what happened is that the X-Men at the end realised that Hungary still exists and that they will vow to do what they can to keep fighting it. Now, this strikes me as being like when Professor X vowed to help Rogue control her powers or vowed to help Wolverine get his memories back, which is where they say, oh, I vow to help you do it. Oh, no, I'm not going to do it. No. I will vow to help you do it and then do nothing.
I think, to be fair, that's the point where what they do then is plug the phone lines for you to make donations to the relief effort.
The more money that you give, the fewer people this demon will kill.
Yes.
A little reductionist.
Yes, that's what I always found a little uncomfortable about Heroes for Hope, that you had this... He's the personification of the Ethiopian famine, except he's not even really about famine, he's about despair.
Yeah, well, what I thought was that if he's going to be manifesting again, because obviously he has to manifest again, he's a Marvel Comics villain, he can't just not come back. He's going to be manifesting somewhere where he's going to be feeding on feelings of hopelessness, self-loathing, despair, loneliness, and it's all exacerbated by extreme famine. The world of fashion needs hunger.
And to be said extreme famine, I was wondering if you were going to suggest he was Nick Clegg.
Yes. So what I'm seeing is Hungary coming back as a fashion designer of some description. I mean, at the moment he's rocking a kind of a sleeveless look with a kind of tabard tunic. He's got the full head hood, which is very in at the moment, with that kind of Green Goblin style little tuck at the back. He's rocking a whole new look for the catwalks. And the X-Men, obviously, high society people that they are, Dazzler gets a few tickets to see a fashion show. They rock up. There's Hungary is about to be recruited by Apocalypse as the new famine for his horsemen. And they have to take on this guy in the epicentre of negative emotion that is New York Fashion Week.
Ooh, I think this the role for Hungary is as a member of the League of Crudely Reductionist Anthropomorphized Social Problems.
Right, okay. Who else is in that team?
Well, they're alongside Hungary, who is basically just a personification of despair. You could have racism, who would just be a personification of despair.
Yeah.
Sexism, who would just be a personification of despair.
Right.
Poverty, who would be a personification of despair.
Yeah.
And Nick Clegg.
Okay. They would work quite well together as a team, I think.
Yes.
Or perhaps they could just be an entire group of villains who symbolise things that annoy toddlers. Like, this one is hungry. This one is bored. Here is a villain called I've Wet My Pants.
The Seven Dwarves for Babies.
Yeah, I think that could work. What do you think?
He's actually sort of a trial run for what Chris Claremont went on and did with the Shadow King towards the end of his run,
yeah.
where Claremont literally does just start saying, here is evil personified as a thingy. Why does he act in an evil way? Because he's evil. Why do other characters act in an evil way? Because they're being influenced by him. Okay.
Yeah, Chris Claremont had a lot of those kind of villains.
Yes, and this guy is almost the prototype for them.
Mm-hmm.
Up until this point, you know, characters tended to have motivations in the X-Men, and there's a point sort of in the few years after this sort of thing...
Where they just got archetypes instead?
Where characters are just evil. Because they are.
I wouldn't mind seeing Hungary going up against the Shadow King, having possessed somebody again and turned them into an enormous fatty like he did with... was it Shan? Or was it Danny? One of the two of them gets possessed by the Shadow King and turned into a massive fatty.
I've just noticed what they have listed under aliases.
Mm-hmm.
And the handbook is always very keen to list anything which is mentioned in passing as an alias, no matter how obviously it's just a throwaway line. Other aliases of Hungary. Entity... Okay. Misery's Maitre D'.
Misery's Maitre D'? That's a whole villain in and of itself.
The Chef of Starvation. The Chef of Starvation.
Misery's Maitre D' and the Chef of Starvation. They presumably work alongside Fin Fang Foom in that restaurant that he washes dishes in.
This feels like it ought to be on some sort of, you know, horrific nightmare of a Gordon Ramsay show. The waiter to the waifs of the world.
It actually, tell me what it sounds like. It's like Hungary is now a wrestler, and it's like, and in the ring corner, Misery's Maitre D, the chef of starvation, the waiter to the waifs of the world, the hash slinger to the homeless, Hungry!
The hash slinger to the homeless. I mean, it's nice that someone's trying to take the edge off for them.
Oh, dear. So, Hungry, somebody who has honestly got endless possibilities for bringing the character back. So that is the official handbook of the Marvel Universe. It's the podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight, I think, as far as I'm aware. And until then, you can get us on our blog, which is houseofastonished.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at IvDestroyed and Al is House to Astonish.
Yep, you can email us. Email address is houseofastonish@gmail.com.
Or you can visit our Facebook fan page.
Yes, just go to Facebook and search for House to Astonish. Also, in the meantime, just our occasional little appeal for iTunes reviews. They always help and very much appreciate everyone that we get. So if you do enjoy the podcast, do consider leaving a little iTunes review. So we'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
See you then.
Bye.